I see the I don't care. It's in the drug use. It's the, you know, I don't care what happens to me. You see that in some of our kids. And I wonder, well, did they reach out somehow and we fail them? Did they protest somehow and we fail them? I mean, who the hell knows? Anyway, I wanted to throw this in. Important features about compatibility are that you have things in common that juice up and nurture the bond, because since only 25% comes from you as a person, then so much more of it has to come from the interests that you have in the outside world. And enough of these interests have to be shared in common so that you can open together, that is, develop together in ways that really help you. That's why I even recommend, I have my list of, you know, what it takes to know if a partner is really available for intimacy. You have to be within at least like a 10-point similarity of IQ. I mean, you have to be with somebody who that you don't have to talk down to or talk up to. Another important feature about compatibility and about a relationship being able to work out is that you have understood each other as introvert or extrovert. We all have both, but usually one predominates either all through life or for a part of life. So you might be in the part of your life when you're more of an introvert, or you might be in the part where you're more of an extrovert. You have to be able to know that about yourself if things are going to work well within the relationship. An introvert is one who, this means, the V-E-R-T means turn. So turn in, introvert, turn out, extrovert. Introvert is depleted by too much contact, and too much contact for introvert means quite little. So even a little contact could be depleting. And an extrovert is one who is animated by contact, and that means a lot of contact. So you could be with someone who is animated by contact, wants to start talking when you get home after a long day's work, when what you want to do when you get home is veg out, go for a run, go to the computer, but it's something alone, because you're not looking for contact when you walk through the door. So compatibility was not associated with these in the past. Compatibility was just about hobbies. But now I want to point out that the essential feature of compatibility is, do you know how to be okay with someone who's introverted, or will you take it as a personal rejection when he needs time alone? Because it isn't personal, really. You're born that way. And it's not as if one is better than the other. We need both for the, you know, human family to have some variety. And if you're, for instance, the type of person who loves to go out, and here's a person who loves to stay home, then that will be considered incompatible. But if you love this person and have accepted that, well, that's just his style, it's not that he's an old stick in the mud, it's not that he's a wallflower, it's just that he's an introvert. Can I say yes to you as you are, which is, of course, the only you there is? Or will you have to match the image that I carry around about what a good partner looks like? It's not just a psychological question, it's a spiritual question. Because, of course, this is the unconditional yes to the givens of life, to the givens of others, to the givens of their personality. And that the study that was done by Gottman, working with couples in the state of Washington, get this, only one out of five characteristics in your personality will ever change. You can go to Freud himself for therapy. It's not going to work. four out of five of your characteristics will be with you all your life. Somehow I got my hands on my fourth grade report card. And in those days, they put little, it was not only like, you know, math and English and all that. They had these like, you know, public school virtues listed. Uses time well. Follows through on tasks and so forth. Anyway, there's a whole list of those, and the teacher had marked me on all of them. I read that list. The few hairs I have stood on end. I said, Mrs. Williams got it exactly right. And I'm still this way. Everything on there was true now. And, you know, it connected to this. Pretty much what you see there is what you're going to get. I'm going to go on to the phases of relationship. We're going to talk about this. But the yes to who you are is the equivalent of a yes to are you an introvert or extrovert. Could be that somebody is withdrawing not because he's an introvert, but because of something else, which I am going to talk about later in detail. So I won't go into it now, but I'll just mention that there are two central fears of intimacy. One is the fear that you might get too close. So that's called the fear of engulfment. You might get so close that I'll be engulfed and lose my freedom. So I have to withdraw for safety. And the other fear is you might go too far away from me, and that's the fear of abandonment, which would make me cling. So imagine one person with the fear of abandonment who's trying to cling while the other has the fear of engulfment is trying to withdraw. You see how that would be a dramatic type of relationship? Chaotic, problematic. We would have to work with these. So we're going to talk about these later. But yes, sometimes it's not being an introvert. It's the withdrawal because you just can't stand that much closeness and never could. You should have known this about yourself way back and made your disclosure so that the partner could make an informed consent. Oh, by the way, just before we make the marriage plans, I need you to know that I have a big fear of closeness. So I'll be pushing you away most of the time. So, you could have both fears, and you could have one fear with one relationship and another with another. We all have both and need them for survival. Remember, we're always looking at the positive side. Without the fear of engulfment, we would lose our boundaries. Without the fear of abandonment, we would lose our connections. Since we need both boundaries and connections. And of course, nature has set that up so that some people are more careful about boundaries and some people are more careful about connections. And the work is to know yourself as you are so that you'd be able to work with this. Imagine all the blaming. I can remember my mother blaming my father because you're a stay-at-home and you never want to take me anywhere. And, you know, she just didn't have this peace that he was this and she's that. Once you get that, then, you know, spend time with people who are extroverted like yourself. And don't try to make your partner be all things to all men, as it were. So that's why, again, the 25% from the one person would mean that you wouldn't get stuck in trying to get too much from someone who just doesn't have it to give. And it's not that he's ungiving. It's that he isn't built that way. Shakespeare, in Measure for Measure, one of the women characters has just had a conversation with a man, and as she walks away, she says to the audience, "I have said too much unto a heart of stone." So sometimes we're with people who who have it to give and won't give it, that's the heart of stone, and we just say too much or give too much, we have to learn how to size up the situation. So that's one of the techniques we'll be talking about. I always thought I was an extrovert, and then I had a therapist friend once, and she said, no, you're not really an extrovert. What you are is you're an introvert who's afraid that if you don't act in an extroverted way, people won't like you. And I thought, she's right. She is right. See, we live in an extroverted world. It's right-handed, extroverted, straight, male, Christian, and so forth. It has all these prejudices. And this is one of them. You know, it's Madison Avenue needs us to be extroverted. This guy's not buying many products. The introvert. You see, we're so looking for someone who has one basic skill. It's the opposite of going. It's the ability to stay with you as you go through things. It's not just stay with me living here in the same house at this address. That wouldn't be enough. I want you to stay with me as I go through my life story and as I walk along on my journey. It's very, very powerful in the human psyche since, now we see how we're building on what we learned before, since it all hangs on a holding environment, you have to be in something in which you feel held. One of the ways you feel held is that someone is willing to stay with you, even in the times when you don't have a lot to give in return. So a truly intimate, available partner is one upon whom you can rely to be with you, even in times when you are depleted, and I don't have much to give right now because of all that I'm going through at work. I don't have much to give right now because of my mother getting close to dying. I don't have much to give right now because by the time you get home, me dealing with these three kids, I'm pretty much worn out. You have to be with somebody who knows enough to stay with you when his own narcissistic needs will not be met. Because that's what it comes down to. In Shakespeare in Romeo and Juliet, what does Romeo say when he goes into the tomb and sees Juliet lying there thinking she's dead? So this is the metaphor of the depleted lover. I still will stay with thee, never from this palace of dim night to depart again. I still will stay with thee, even when she isn't offering anything. That's a powerful way that we know we're loved and we know what love is. Compare that statement to the statement made to Juliet by the monk after she wakes up and Romeo is dead. She wakes up and the monk says, the monk tries to get her to leave the tomb before she notices that Romeo is dead, because he knows that if she sees that he's dead, she won't want to leave. So he says, I dare no longer stay. A greater power than we can contradict hath thwarted our attempt to get you two together. It hasn't worked out. I dare no longer stay. That's so different from, I still will stay with thee. So he puts his finger right on the central human question. Will you stay with me when the evening comes? Or will you say, I dare no longer stay? To find someone willing to stay as you go through your availability and unavailability, your depletion and abundance, your being fun and being no fun, your being depressed and being animated, which is how all human beings live their life, moving back and forth between these polarities along a spectrum, that willingness to stay is the equivalent of being loved and feeling loved. Some people can say they love you, but you don't feel loved. How do you feel loved? You feel loved when you notice, I still will stay with thee. When you feel that the work is happening, like a person says, well, yeah, I am working on it, but it takes time. When that's believable and you stay, that's healthy staying. When it's not believable and you still stay, that's the codependency. That's the we are the birds that stay. Like, how do I know how to take care of myself? How do I know when I'm being taken for a ride? How do I know when there's a sincere work happening and I just have to allow it to unfold in its own timing? Those are questions that one can't answer with a set of rules. But you get to be more skilled at intuiting those kinds of realizations as you do the other work. The other work I'm describing outfits you to be more on top of what's going on. You'll see how that connection is made. Everybody see how that works? I mean, you can't come up with a list of rules. How do I know when to come and go? But all that you can do is become so loyal to reality and working on how to become loyal to reality, which I believe is done centrally by practicing the unconditional yes to the givens of the other and knowing what's given that is unchangeable, just the natural condition of something, and what's workable. So there are givens and workables. And you just automatically are able to tell the difference as you keep practicing the unconditional yes to the reality rather than the picture in my mind. Oh, let me not be seduced by this picture I carry around in the locket of my mind. Let me rather look directly into the face of this perhaps unappealing reality and call it by name. Martin Buber, Jewish existentialist philosopher, in his book I and Thou, he says, the only way to work with an incubus is to call it by name. Incubus, something weighing on you. Latin and Italian word for nightmare. Something that's really bothering you, but you have to, you know, bring out that Rumpelstiltskin. That's how you start to work with it. But we'll talk about that because that's the first part of the work, the ability to see and to address reality as it is. So when do I say this? I accept that I'm receiving a limited dividend from this investment, this relationship. And when does it become I'm selling myself short? Mysterious questions that don't have specific answers, but something in you eventually knows and wakes up. That's the moment of enlightenment. And if you were in that moment of enlightenment to disregard it, that would be a terrible injustice to yourself. As Shakespeare says, there is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. And then omitted, all the voyage of their life is lost in shallows and in miseries. So in other words, you get to that particular moment when you finally see it. Oh, this isn't just a limited dividend. This is a dividend that gets smaller every day. And I'm here waiting for it to change. And no work is being done on the other side to get it to change. So where do I go? This is my time to make my move. When you get to that moment and make a move, that's there is a tide in the affairs of men which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. When you don't do that, when you just say, well, I think I'll wait a little longer, then your boat goes into the shallows. So let's take that word expectation. This part, the X, means outside, and this means, we used to have an S in here, so this means to look as in a spectator, spect. In expectation, you look outside for what is really inside, because this word also means, the P-E-C-T, also means heart, as in pectoral cross, heart. So, in other words, the inner life of yourself, you're looking outside for what you could look for inside. And if you, of course, are caught in the self-loathing that is so much a part of our inner landscape, it's hard to look inside because you don't trust that there's anything in there worth looking for. So all expectations have to be let go of, and the only thing that can take their place, since expectation is one-sided, we want something that's two-sided with other people. And so wherever there's an expectation, I ask for an agreement. Now, an agreement is between two people. So one way to do this work is to examine your expectations and to change them into requests for agreements with a partner. For instance, I expect you to be faithful. Let's make an agreement about monogamy. I expect you to make the dinner, since I'm working all day. I expect to have a hot meal when I get home. Let's make an agreement that that's how we are going to do it. That's different from I expect. Obviously, you're going to get a lot more accomplished if you come from this perspective also. So you ask for agreements wherever there are expectations. And at the same time, since now you've become more wary of how humans are, you also accept the given that some people don't keep agreements. And so when the agreement is not kept, you say, okay, an agreement was made. It's not being kept. Where do we go from here? So let's come up with another, let's continue to work on this. When you come in with these kinds of attitudes that I'm describing now, an adult change comes into the relationship. Because children have a right to expect that when they get home from school, there'll be a snack waiting, or at least the peanut butter and jelly will be out on the counter for use. You can make your own. But it's reasonable to have that expectation. But in the adult world, everything has to be expressed in so many words in order for you to trust that it could happen. Everybody follow? So I would start with that as a way of knowing the difference between the givens and the workables. If you're with somebody who keeps agreements, that means it's a workable relationship. Or another way of putting it, which makes it even easier, is to ask ourselves, what is meant by a commitment? Does a commitment mean that you have bought the ring, or that you're married, or that you've been together for a while? Is that what a commitment is? Or does a commitment mean that you're monogamous? I'm opening that subject up in a little different way and saying, you know it's a commitment in two basic ways. First, you have noticed that you are together in handling obstacles that come up. And secondly, you keep agreements. If you have these two, a person who is willing to handle obstacles with you, work things out, and keep agreements once they are worked out, the agreements that flow from the working out, that's the equivalent of, I have enough to go on that this is workable. If instead you notice that obstacles just hang on as smoldering resentments and agreements are not kept but continually broken, that's when you know it's not really workable. It's the given of how it is. So then, of course, you go back to what we said before. You're either going to work it out or go. Our grandparents didn't have that option. They couldn't go. And they didn't even have the option of working it out, because they didn't even have therapy as we know it now. So the models that we saw were themselves wounded, Baudelaireized, inadequate, distorted. The only place we could look for some kind of example of relationships that work was the movies. You know, you could see Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn working things out somehow. And, oh, that's what it looks like. And then you wind up happy. But even that is not the best place to get your psychology from, obviously. Let me go on to our other topic. I want to be sure to have us look at the three phases that most couples go through. And this will help us with many of these other questions. Obviously, the first phase is romance. In romance, we have two egos that meet two ego ideals. And so our decision about the other is based on an ideal, which obviously contains the word idea. It's different from real. So it's based on an ideal. And as I said before, that's perfectly okay. Because that's, you know, what makes life interesting and fun, and there's no problem as long as you always keep in mind what it's really about. Kind of reminds me of the ancient Roman custom when a general returned from successful campaigns in other lands. He marched into Rome, and they often had built a triumphal arch under which he could travel in his procession. They had a procession in which they showed all the booty that he had brought back from the other country and the slaves and so forth. And then he was in a chariot in his full costume, and all the people were lined up on both sides of the procession throwing flowers and praising him. Okay. And he would march along the Appian Way to the Senate, where he would be received by the senators and the emperor and congratulated for his success. Fine. Now here's the interesting thing. In ancient religion, the greatest fear was the fear of hubris. Hubris means Greek word for arrogance. The belief that your achievements are the result of your own ego efforts rather than the graces and gifts that were given to you by the gods. We have the same concept in Christianity. We have the same concept in the Pure Land Buddhism, that it's not just by sitting on the pillow that you achieve enlightenment. It's a gift of Amitabha to you directly. So this is an ancient archetypal realization that it's not about human effort only. You have to receive something, not just achieve something. So anyway, in order to be sure that the general did not fall into hubris, next to him in the chariot was a slave whose job was simply this. Every 2 or 3 minutes, he had to say to the general, "You are only a man. You are not a god. You did not achieve all this on your own. It was thanks to Apollo. Diana helped you. You are not a god. You are only a man." He kept saying this during the entire procession. Isn't that interesting? I mean, it's like building in the reminder, because you could get so puffed up when you see all the people throwing flowers and so forth. Anyway, that is what would have to go, because that is all based on, I have become the ideal. And that's what you feel in romance. You feel that you have become the ideal and found it at the same time. So I am an ideal because the other person treats you that way. I am an ideal man, and this is an ideal woman. And so forth. Or man and man, woman and woman. So So we're a little bit in trouble when we're in this romantic phase, but we're going to enjoy it, and we're going to let it run its course. And we're not going to be disappointed when it comes to an end. And it goes on to the second phase, which is struggle. And this is when two egos butt up against two egos. And the ideal has been dropped. Instead, you now see the dark side of the ego, which Jung calls the shadow archetype, and you meet up with that part. And of course, I've noticed in my own life that there's nothing like relationship to bring out your dark side. I mean, you hear yourself saying such nasty things, you think, gee, I would never have said that before. And this is the one that I'm supposed to be, you know, in love with. But, oh yeah, it comes out. Why does it come out? Because nature has a different purpose now. The purpose here was procreation. So let everything look good. And let them have at least one or two to keep everything going. But now nature has a different purpose. Now the purpose is work out the unfinished business of your childhood. Work out the unfinished business of your adulthood. Work things out. And you're not going to work things out until you drop all the ideals and go straight to the real. Of course, now we know from what we said about hubris and grace that it's not even about working things out fully. From the spiritual perspective, we also need help in working things out. One of the symbols of this kind of help is also in ancient Rome. They had not only the gods that we know about, the 12 gods on Mount Olympus, but they also had little gods who took care of little parts of the house. For instance, they had the Lares and Penates. The Lares take care of your hearth, and the other ones take care of the cupboards. They had Janus, who takes care of the gate, which looks in two directions. They had another one that takes care of the threshold. Oh, yes. They had every part of the house was protected by a separate divinity, all of whom received prayers and incense, you know, acknowledgement. What does this mean? Does it mean that there really are gods like that? No, of course not. It means that people have always noticed this work is so big, you can't do it on your own. You've got to have some help from powers higher, better than yourself. And that would be higher power, God, however you want to look at it. Okay, so the second phase is the struggle in which the two egos are not finding the object of the beseeching gaze, but they're getting tired of looking at that other side. So this leads us to the third phase, which is the most wonderful one, and that is commitment, which I just described. Now you can handle obstacles and keep agreements. This is where the marriage is supposed to take place. We've got it up here in the romance. This is where our parents got married when they were in the romantic phase. They hadn't gotten to this yet. Now, you know, people live together and they wait to get married. They don't, in other countries, they even wait after having children. But here, you tend to get married at that point. But the real place to get married is when it's an actual marriage. What is an actual marriage? Two people, instead of egos, two people are together and tell the world that they're together, and that's marriage. As opposed to, oh, we're all hot for each other, so we should get married. You really have to go through a little bit of this to know if you're going to be with somebody with whom it's workable and with whom you can work things out in such a way as to move along to the real connection, which is in the commitment. And these three phases are based on a study done of California couples, and they noticed that they went through that this was the that the romance was the shortest phase, and this was the longest struggle. And that this phase, too, went in two directions. It either went off the chart to divorce or into commitment. And it's 3 out of 4 that go to the divorce and 1 out of 4 that goes to the commitment. So that tells you something about the importance of the work and the importance of I realized this like a minute before I sent my manuscript to the publisher, and I immediately added in new paragraphs. I said, wait a minute. There's another phase I found before romance. And it's called investigation. It's when you look into what the whole thing is really about. This vest in Latin means clothing. In means into or in. You have to look behind the clothes that you see. See what it's really about. Investigate. We didn't do this before. We made the decision on the basis of the adrenaline. This is the chemical reaction. This is where I'm all excited, so this is the right person. Oh, I feel things with this person I didn't ever feel with anybody else. It's all well and good. But in addition to that, you want to investigate. Okay, so does that make it just a fun romance that will have a beginning, middle, and end? Or is this the makings of a true commitment? Now that we're no longer caught up in the traditional Judeo-Christian view of you meet someone and then you get married and have children, now we have the option of having romantic relationships without having to get married. That gives us the chance to investigate. It doesn't mean we don't go with the chemistry. It just means that we become wary, suspicious. Does the chemistry here represent a threshold into an authentic possibility for me for a lifelong relationship? Or does this chemistry represent only a short-term connection in which we'll have lots of fun and then move on? This is a question we didn't ask in the past. Now we can ask this question and answer it. How do we answer it? Stay long enough to get to the struggle. Fear not, you will get there. Now I have this little thing that I do when I go to a movie. When I see the two people being romantic and all the chemistry and so forth, I make a mental note of that image. And then later when they get to the struggle, I reconnect them. I think to myself, okay, remember that scene when you were like that and look at you now? Because that helps me remind myself that things change. It places the slave beside me in the chariot of romance. Remember, this is only a picture. Remember, this is not real. Remember, this is adrenaline speaking. Remember, you need that. Our friends often do that for us. That's why it's good to, share with them as we go through our relationship issues. Okay, questions? Yeah.
When you start out as friends.
I think it's a great place to start. She's saying, what if you start as friends instead of with all the adrenaline? More reliable, but still not knock them dead. But more reliable. Nothing is fully reliable. I mean, that's why we have the three refuges. Nothing's reliable. That's why someone said, for thou art with me. What did they mean? They noticed things aren't reliable. They noticed the impermanence of people's commitment, the impermanence of reality, the impermanence of people. And psychology gave us a technology for dealing with Buddha's impermanence. That technology is grief. That's the technology built into mammals to handle the fact of impermanence. Otherwise, life would be a cruel joke. If all we had was impermanence and no way to handle it, that would be all wrong. No, we have impermanence. We have Buddha's reminder about it with an Eightfold Path. And psychologically, we have the grief work to handle the impermanence. In fact, as you move from one phase to the other, you would, for instance, grieve together that the thrill is gone. Instead of lamenting or blaming, you could lament, but instead of blaming, you would say, oh, it looks like we're starting to have some arguments. The, you know, flush of romance is now gone. Rico was right. And now it's time to grieve. And so, you know, you grieve together. That would be a good way to enter into the struggle phase. And then, of course, you're grieving here as one by one, all the illusions fall away. Oh, I thought you'd never have an affair. Now that has happened. Oh, I thought you would always be there for me, and now you're not. Oh, that has happened. Each time something like that happens, there is a technology right inside you. It's grieving. That's why you would automatically cry. Crying releases the grief. And with it, the stress that these losses bring. So the grieving mechanism is in us for homeostatic purposes so that we could even out. The one in Buddhist tradition is one of the four immeasurables, which is equanimity, the ability to greet reality. So this part means equal. First part means equal, and this part means spirit, as in animation, the lively energy within you remains the same, equal, in the face of the jolts that life brings. So disappointments from partners, for instance, is a jolt to the psyche that expected that you wouldn't disappoint. And if I can greet that with equanimity, in other words, I can find a way to place that among the givens that I've said yes to and somehow work on it with you, then that's the equivalent of becoming healthier personally and building a commitment in the partnership. Shakespeare has such a beautiful description of equanimity. This is Hamlet speaking to Horatio. Thou hast been one whom fortune's buffets or rewards hath taken with equal thanks. Whether you get hit with a jolt or whether you get rewarded with a hug, you say thanks in both instances. A powerful statement. He was on a high spiritual plane when he came up with that one. And, of course, you know the Tibetan Buddhist saying, disappointment is the fastest chariot to enlightenment. Why? Because it's the release of illusion. You're no longer caught in the illusion that you had about that person. If you look at it that way, that's where the thanks comes in. So I would say that some of the loving kindness practice really helps in relationship, especially if you can do it together. I recommend that, doing the practices as your own little sangha, you know, within the relationship. It turns the holding environment into a zendo. And there's something then that happens that refreshes the program that you're working with, if you see what I mean. There was another question. Yeah.
So would you say you'd need to go through grief in order to forgive?
Yes. He's saying, does the grief also lead to forgiveness? See, forgiveness is not something you can just do. It's, shall we say, the result of the work done. What is the work? That when you grieve, it leads to a letting go. And when you get to that letting go point, what you have let go of is the blame, and that is forgiveness. Forgiveness is letting go of the blame and the resentment and the need to retaliate. I have let go of blame, resentment, and the need to retaliate. When you get to that point, the forgiveness just happens on its own. Forgiveness is Paul Tillich, the Lutheran theologian and president of the Harvard School of Divinity in the 60s, he has a beautiful definition. Forgiveness is forgetting in spite of remembering. Forgiveness is forgetting in spite of remembering. So you remember what happens, but forget it. Let it go. Put it behind you. I want to go on this afternoon to our other two topics, one of which is the fear that comes up in relationship, and the other is the specific way to work with the issues. So I'll do that, and then we'll have questions as we go along. But first, right after the morning, someone asked me a question that I wanted to get back to. And I also wanted to mention, just in case it wasn't clear, that the way we join into the enterprise of becoming fully human is ever to be on the lookout for the people, places, things, and practices, hobbies, careers, and so forth, that create the holding environment that is the one in which we are paid attention to, accepted as we are, appreciated, shown affection, and allowed to make our graceful exit if we need to. And that is different from the original theory in psychology that if you missed out on it in early life, it can never be made up for later. Now we understand that you can make up for enough of it to have a healthy life. You don't have to have received it all from childhood. You keep getting chances, and you even were during childhood from your brothers and sisters, your aunts, your uncles, teachers at school, scoutmaster, anybody that you related to who, shall we say, saw you as, Emerson says, as you inly are. And occasionally there were people like that. And then finally, before we go on, that is the equivalent, that realization of, oh, here's someone who sees me and loves me just as I am. That's the unconditional love. And that we have the kind of relationship in which we can be with each other in what Buber calls the I-thou relationship, or I-you. And I want to connect this to the Buddhist principle of impermanence, because this will be momentary. There will be moments in which someone sees you without his or her mother or father's face on you. There will be moments in which you will be seen without projections, expectations, needs, and desires. There will be moments at which a bond is occurring that is truly real between you. And, oh, so this is who you are, and I'm seeing you just as you are right in this minute, and, oh, I just hadn't seen you this way before. Oh, now I see the tender vulnerability that is really you now that you've let down all the defenses of being controlling and in charge. Making us even wonder if the reason we're so much in control and in charge is so that we won't have to be met as we really are. Is that what I'm doing? Am I trying to hide the most beautiful part of me, which is the part that is vulnerable to how other people react to me? This part is the Latin word for wound. So vulnerable is one who is soft enough to be wounded. He hasn't created a hard shell over his heart so that you can't get to him. And this I call the healthy vulnerability, not the vulnerability of the victim who just lets himself be wounded with arrows flying into him like Saint Sebastian, but more like the vulnerability of the dear and precious openness that the heart is capable of. That kind of raw presence with others that shows how needy we can be, for instance, at times, is what allows for the little moment to open in which the I sees you. I can finally see you. And I also add that the five A's are also momentary. They're not meant to be happening all the time. And even motherly moments, fatherly moments. So I may not have even now what I want to receive from my mother, but I notice that I am open to motherly moments that come to me from other men or women. And I'm open to fatherly moments in which I feel held and protected in that special way from men or women. And that's enough to survive on. So even if it didn't happen a lot, I finally let myself feel it coming through. Okay. Everybody get this basic idea? I wanted to bring in this idea of momentary because this is our continually going back to the fact of impermanence, which applies to relationship, that the little moments in which we actually feel loved are to be cherished, and it's okay that they're momentary, because if they weren't momentary, it might happen to us what Mary Oliver warns us about, that you become so comfortable that you just slide into inanimateness. You know, you just... So instead, we're kind of on our toes. We're waiting for the little moment to happen. And that's okay. All right, so let's just take a look at the two basic fears that come up in relationship, and they're very simple. Since relationship is about closeness and distance, it's built right into the word. I mean, if it's a relationship between one thing and another, then that means they somehow can't be exactly the same. They have to be looking at each other, so there's distance in between. It's normal for all relationships to have continually changing ratios of closeness and distance. But the closeness for some will be scary, even in bite-sized pieces. And that is called the fear of engulfment. I might be swallowed up by the closeness. I might lose my freedom. And the distance part can be scary, because that could mean that you have abandoned me, and so I have the fear of abandonment. The engulfment, as we said before, would make you want to get away from the smothering hugs. And the abandonment fear would make you want to hold on for dear life, and that's the clinging that most people don't like. So here you are pushing away by what you're doing. That's the irony of it. And here you are trying to get away when you at the same time do want some kind of relationship. Or as Maggie Scarf says in her book, Intimate Partners, showing the game dimension of this. He runs, but never so fast as to get away. She pursues, but never so fast as to catch. Could that be what we're up to? Could we be kind of playing this like I have to act as if I have to show that I fear the closeness because that's the only way I'll get the level of closeness I can handle. And I have to fear the abandonment because that's the only way I'll be able to get some semblance of the closeness that I require. We would want to look into this. We would want to know ourselves. With the person who feels engulfed, then the five A's themselves will feel like impingements. They will feel like they're somehow intrusive. For instance, let's say you pay attention. You might even ask questions showing that you have, yet you care about what's going on with this person. But he takes the questions as intrusive, not as loving inquiries. And on this side, when the person needs the space and you have to realize, well, I can't get all my needs met here, and so this pushes me out into the world to get my needs met elsewhere also, that could be felt as a terrible rejection. It's a series of misunderstandings that pass back and forth, which happens in many relationships. A lot of it is misunderstanding. Like, oh, you don't quite see that I can't handle that much closeness. Oh, you don't quite see that I can't handle that much distance. So we have two possibilities. We can either stay in this, or we can work on ourselves in some way to release the other from the abandonment side and to invite the other from the engulfment side. So my recommendation is that we work with these fears using what I call the triple A approach. First, you admit that you have the fear. That's hard to do in itself. And admitting is always the first step in recovery. It's the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We admitted. It's an interesting word, because admit in English means both, let's see, say that something is true of you, acknowledge, but it also means admit, let in, ticket for admission, let in. So you finally let it in that you really are scared. Instead of saying, you get way too close, I can't handle it, what the hell's wrong with you? Say, I get scared when someone gets that close. And it goes all the way back to childhood. And I do want to work on it, but I want you to know that I do get scared. So that's admitting. Secondly, you would have to allow the feeling fully. So you would allow the fear to happen in you. Shudder, shake, feel scared, be anxious. Instead of looking for a way to avoid the fear, instead of taking Xanax or turning on the TV or calling a friend or gambling, sex, drugs, alcohol, whatever. So many distractions so that we don't have to feel our feelings. But in this instance, you're doing the work, and the work will be to allow the feeling to come through. To be compassionate to yourself in having this feeling, rather than letting the inner critic blame you for being a scaredy cat, you would say, no, it's not that. It's that I'm feeling a fear that has its roots in early life, most likely, and now is a phantom fear. Because I can't really be engulfed, except in the case of murder. But I'm not going to be engulfed by somebody hugging me, that's for sure. So I'm feeling a phantom fear. It's not really there. The danger is not really there. So I need to allow that fear to happen and just kind of go with it. And then finally, and this is a big part, to act as if the fear could not stop or drive you. Or you could also say, act so that the fear does not stop or drive you. The fear doesn't have to stop me from being in a relationship and letting intimacy happen. And the fear doesn't have to drive me to Las Vegas to get away from it all and do some gambling. So that's how I would act in such a way that I could, shall we say, live with the fear. And since by doing this, we come to a more enlightened state. This is the equivalent of the Buddhist Tantra. What is the Tantra? It's the practice based on the belief that the pain that brings you to the Dharma is itself the Dharma that brings you to enlightenment. So you take what you're actually working with, or what